Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Adrian Salbucci. Adrian is a researcher. He's an author, a journalist, a speaker, an international consultant on political and public risk management. He's held top management posts in major multinational risk management companies. He's done a great deal, and he lives down in Argentina. He's also familiar, among other things, with Israel's reported large land purchase in Patagonia. We want to talk about it. And other topics, Adrian sent me an article about the false flag terror bombing. We want to get into that a little bit. I've written a little bit about false flags that have gone on in different places, done by different countries. Well, we might touch on that, too. But, Adrian, I welcome you to the program.
Well, great to be on your show, Stephen. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a delight. It really is. Where shall we begin? You pick the topic area to begin with.
Well, I think that maybe just sort of to start getting into these various subjects, which are very important that you just mentioned, a value that I can bring to the table, so to speak, is that I live in a country which is peripheral. In other words, we are not one of the major central industrialized countries of Europe or the United States or the Far East. We tend to see things from far away, which gives us a different perspective, in a way, as to what is even happening within this so-called New World Order itself. And, for example, on the financial and the economic stages, we've gone through repeated meltdowns. So, in a way, we start to understand how the whole mechanism works and what are the objectives behind them. I'm 58 years old, and I've gone through three generalized meltdowns in my adult life, from 1975, 1989, we had hyperinflation, and in 2001, 2002, we had a complete banking, financial, and economic collapse.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, I have written about it, Adrian, the defaulting on the debt and all the rest.
Exactly. So when things like that happen and your life really gets all all screwed up, you start asking yourself, well, what is happening here? And you start scratching your head, and you try to think, well, what is it that is happening? And in a way, we stand a greater chance of actually understanding what the mechanism is like, and not in a way you're luckier than we are, obviously, because in the first world, in the United States and Europe, they've been able, the powers that be, they have been able to make the whole growth and collapse cycle last 80 years. From 1929, 1930 until 2008, almost 80 years, actually. In Argentina, our cycle is much shorter, so we just sort of fall apart every 17 or 18 years, which is, the added advantage, quote-unquote, that we have. For you guys, the last depression was just a black-and-white photograph of people online for a dish of soup. For us, it's something much more closer to our generalized life in the last years.
Oh, indeed. And Argentina has the misfortune of, as they say, as the powerful people in America say, being in America's backyard, that horrible dismissive phrase. But unfortunately, America's backyard, as it was referred to many decades ago, the world is now America's backyard. So one of the benefits of being a superpower is you can exploit other countries and benefit greatly, especially when your currency is the world's reserve one. We literally force other people to buy our currency. That's a long and involved story, and a guy who understands it much better than I do wrote a whole book on it, Michael Hudson. He called it Super Imperialism, and I wrote about his book, but I'd much rather have him come on, and he does, to explain it than I go through it all. But Argentina is on the receiving end of that exploitation, so you go through all these convulsions over time, and other countries do the same thing, and of course the world is going through a massive convulsion right now, thanks to the forces that run my country, the ones that I call the dark forces, Adrian.
Well, you know, Steve, I was going to say just that, because for many, many decades down here, there was a tendency for people to say, oh, it's the Americans, it's the fault of the Americans, Yankee go home, and this and that. And in the last 20 years, I think people have awakened to the fact, and I certainly stress it, that the peoples of countries are never enemies. Our enemy are not the people of the United States or the people of Britain or the people of whatever country you want to choose, and nor are the enemies of any other country, let's say the people of another country. It's usually the power elite, which today is really global in nature, and for various very good reasons, they have chosen the United States of America as the place from where they can operate, basically because it's the largest economy, basically because it has a military prowess that is completely irresistible. But now, and this is probably the tragedy of America today, you're waking up to the fact that they were never on your side to begin with, and now the time has come for them to, in a way, sacrifice large sectors of the American populace or large sectors of the European populace, and they really couldn't give a darn what really happens to you. So all of a sudden, now you're on the receiving end, the way Argentinians or Colombians or people from the Middle East or people from the Far East were, and that they're treating you just as bad, perhaps even worse than they're treating us.
Well, Adrian, I would rephrase the beginning of what you said. Rather than they willingly went along with us, my feeling is that we basically said, this is the way it'll be, and you will go along, and we had a lot more power than they ever did. And if we go back just to the more modern era, post-World War II, I think I used a line in an article I wrote way back where I said, at the end of that war, America was the only country left standing. I mean, the world was decimated. Not Latin America. They weren't particularly scathed by the war. They weren't scathed at all by the war. But Europe, Africa is poor, so they don't matter in terms of any sort of power, being in the power structure. Asia, for sure. So America, untouched, separated by two great bodies of water that don't really make a difference anymore, because anybody can get across those. Anybody with today's technology can cross those bodies of water easily. But way back then, they couldn't do it. So we were the only one left standing, and we made the rules, and we prospered until things started changing gradually. And I'll have a guest on this program, Adrian. Oh, he's somebody I wanted to get for a long time, but I still can't get him until December. But he'll go into it when he comes on, and he believes that America's decline began back in the 1970s. And another guest I've had on a couple of times earlier believe it began literally in the 1950s because of the Korean War and the Vietnam War being the motor driving America in the wrong direction, plus a lot of bad politics, greedy politicians, greedy empowered people in big business. And since the 1970s, especially in America, there's been a great wealth transfer from most people to the elite folks at the top, and mainly the top 1%. And it's gotten worse and worse and worse. And they drain the world, Adrian. They drain people here, and they drain people around the world. But you're right on the second half of what you were talking about. There are leaders in nations, and we leave the people of these countries out of it, as you said. The people have, well, I don't make the policies of my country. You don't make the policies of Argentina. They could be the wickedest people in the world. It's not your fault. It's not my fault. And if we had anything to say about it, it wouldn't be that way. So it's not our fault. It's the people who run the darn place. But other countries are starting to balk, and they're balking at the dollar as the world's reserve currency. They're balking at other things. And I guess things have a way of coming to a head when you get an economic crisis as we are now, and then it's everybody for themselves.
Well, you know, as I was listening to you, and I fully agree with everything that you're saying, I think that one of the things that it's a good idea to at least try and get a better grasp of everything that's been happening and that is happening and that will be happening is that we have to understand that the powers that be who normally operate or organize themselves around specific think tanks, or at least that's where the planning comes from, like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the Bilderberg Conference, and so forth. What they are very good at, and we are not, usually, because public opinion is just more fickle in that sense, they are very good at long-term planning. And very often we've lost the long-term of our perspective. So we're very short-term. You know, we think that, we've got to get our jobs going, get our companies going, we have to, you know, pay things next week, and long-term for most of us is maybe a year in the future. These guys have been planning for decades, even centuries. So when the Second World War ends back in 1945, they had already taken a decision to move towards a world government, but they knew that that was going to take generations and generations, because you not only change the way technology works or the economy works or politics works, you have to change people's minds, people's culture. So in a way, when they spoke of the New World Order of 1946, 1947, with the Truman Doctrine and so forth, of containment of the Soviet Union, they'd say, we're going to divide the world in two. And it's going to be schizophrenic. You're going to have the Soviets and their allies on the one side, America and its allies on the other side, and it's going to be extremely unfair and unjust, but it's going to be stable. It was a relatively stable world. It's the world you and I were brought up in. But around 1970, 75, especially with Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Age, they decided to move forward towards globalization. And they said, well, one of these two superpowers has got to go. And the one that had to go was the Soviet Union. And, you know, it's absolute proof that there is one sole hand governing the whole world, that you would have expected, oh, the Soviet Union is not going to go. They're going to raise hell. They're going to unleash a nuclear war. And yet nothing happened. They just said, oh, dear, bring down the Berlin Wall. Let Germany reunify itself. Free all those people. We're no longer Marxists. Let's start being capitalists. And we all scratched our heads and said, what? But then we had 20 years of globalization. The tragedy, Stephen, and this is something that I really stress a lot, is that globalization was not the final stage. Globalization has been the 20 years during which they perfected all the electronic surveillance infrastructure, internet, global telephone, global TV, global radio, I don't know, cellular phones and everything, radio frequency identification chips and so forth. And they've reached the conclusion that those 20 years have been enough, and now they want to move on towards a world government, a real world government. And you know what? Just as it was necessary for the Soviet Union to disappear when they transitioned from globalization, from the bipolar world to globalization, now that they are transitioning from globalization to world government, they need for the United States to go. They are looking for the demise of the United States. Not that you're going to be blown off the map, just as the Soviet Union wasn't erased from the map. But where we used to have the Soviet Union, now we have Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, the Baltic states, and so forth. They will do the same thing with the United States. They can no longer risk in a world government having a superpower like America, because for the last 20 years, America has been in friendly hands for them, the Clintons, the Bushes, the Obamas. But what would happen if a real patriot were to one day reach the Oval Office and the guy were to say, I've had it with the Federal Reserve, I've had it with the banking system, I've had it with all these interventions in Iraq and wars in Afghanistan and so forth, and I've had it with giving this unconditional support to the state of Israel, and we're going to start doing something that is really geared on the American national interest, oh dear, that would be a hell of a problem. So they need for the United States to go.
Oh, you put so many thoughts in my mind, Adrian. I could go off in five different directions right now. Let me throw one at you. In my dreams, I can only wish for a couple of things, that the whole down world would get mad as hell at us, number one, and that we really did have a patriot become our head of state. With enough firepower behind him so that he would stay alive long enough to do what he really wanted to do. Maybe the closest thing we had in the 20th century, and he was far far from perfect by a long shot. But Jack Kennedy wanted to do at
Absolutely.
Least a couple of things. He wanted to get out of Vietnam. He wanted to get rid of the CIA. He wanted to have nothing to do with another Bay of Pigs. He basically thought that the right-wing fringe that wanted him to do these crazy things, he thought they were a bunch of lunatics. He wanted absolutely nothing to do with them. And, well, we know what happened to him. And
it Best president you ever had, yeah.
It certainly wasn't at the hands of a lone gunman. My God, it was a CIA-sponsored hit squad that took him out. Just the way they took out Martin Luther King and they took out Bobby Kennedy. I mean, this goes on and on. But the one other thing I wanted to throw in, and I thought we were going to talk about Israel-Palestine, but
you pulled the shot, and
Patagonia and the rest of it. But one other thing I wanted to throw in, I had Daniel Estulin on the program some time
ago.
Good
friend of mine. Good
and he
friend
wrote about the Bilderbergers. I guess he's about as expert as anybody who is not a Bilderberger themselves. I guess they know a lot about it. But Daniel seems to know what goes on at their meetings before the meetings are even held. I don't know how he does it. He seems to get hold of the agenda. But in his book, he had a quote by some U.S. official. I don't know if he was an official. Some American, and I don't recall the name or if he even mentioned it, who testified before Congress in the 1950s. It was a chilling testimony, and he said, "One day we will have a one-world government, and there's not a darn thing you can do to stop it."
That was James Warburg, the son of the guy who founded the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, Paul Warburg. His son James said that in Congress in the 1950s, exactly.
I mean, I read that quote. I said, "Oh my God!" I mean, in the 1950s.
But no. You know why, Steve? Because they are long-term planners.
They're very patient, Adrian.
And they're very patient. And another thing that we have, because you see, we have to start imitating their methods. For example, they know that they have to micromanage and macromanage a whole host of things. And different things go at different speed. For example, finance goes forward minute by minute, even second by second. I mean, things, you know, you can have $1 trillion invested in Argentina and you say, "Oh God, Argentina's very happy," and all of a sudden, electronically, you can remove $1 trillion from Argentina and you can throw us way into a hell of a dump. So, you know, finance can move forward in just a couple of minutes. The economy moves forward in days, weeks, even months. If GM decides to set up a car plant in Bolivia, well, it's going to take months of planning and building the plant and so forth. Politics takes literally years. Like, you know, the basic so-called democratic rationale is that if you vote a president in, you got to bear with him for 4 years. And with whatever Congress you have to bear with it for 4 years. So politics goes forward in years. Culture, you can have cultural change. It takes literally generations. I mean, if you look at all the psychological warfare, most of it is geared on young kids because they know that the old-timers like us are just not going to buy all that stuff. But they know that, okay, we'll forget about the oldies like me, I'm 58, and let's just concentrate on the younger kids, those who are in their 30s who are about to take over as the management class, and even the kids who are just born who are in grade school. Let's start changing their minds around. So they know that all of these things, they have to move forward flexibly, they have to move forward shrewdly, they have to have plan B, plan C, plan D for just about every contingency. But all in all, if you ask yourself, well, where are these guys going? Well, we've had an informal world government that's been governed through the Bilderbergs and the trilaterals and the CFRs and the major corporations and the Goldman Sachs of this world and so forth. But now, after globalization, which served a huge purpose of installing the electronic infrastructure, now they want to go forward into what will be a formal world government. And one of the things I tell my people down here in Argentina is, hey, I'm going to repeat that. A world government is coming. Argentina is in the world, and they're going to force us to integrate that world government the way they want, not the way we want, and there's not going to be anything we can do about it. So we better start thinking, how are we going to handle this?
Oh, indeed so. And they really do it incrementally. And by the way, one of the rewards of being patient is they have gotten very rich along the way. There's nothing wrong with being a patient. You can wait for the ultimate coup d'etat when you literally have the world in your back pocket. But these people have gotten super rich. There's nothing wrong with becoming a billionaire. I mean, you can be very patient when you've got a billion or two or five or whatever sitting wherever you want. Of course, in a tax haven, so you pay no taxes. That's another element of our system. Maybe that's the element of the powerful everywhere, Adrian, but it sure is here with all the big money secreted overseas, and only the little people pay taxes. That's the way the system works. And then they hire people like Alan Greenspan and Bernanke, the so-called Fed chairman, who are literally tools of Wall Street, and they're obedient and they obey orders and they do what they're told and they print all the money that they control and then they loot the treasury to make their $1 billion, $2 billion, or $5 billion, or $100 billion, whatever they want to do, and the amounts then start getting into trillions. Well, you remember Everett Dirksen back in the 50s or so. So said a billion here, a billion there is real money. Well, today that's just pocket change.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Now we're talking about a trillion here, a trillion there, and pretty soon we'll be talking about 10 trillion, 100 trillion. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, this stuff sounds so ludicrous that if it weren't true, you couldn't make it up. Nobody would believe what you're talking about. But I'm just rambling now. I think I had a point, but I forgot what it was.
No, but you know, there's one aspect. You just mentioned one of my favorites, which is Alan Greenspan, you know, the Trilateral Commission director. He's also a director on the Council on Foreign Relations. Before this guy became the governor of the Federal Reserve back in 1987, when George Bush had just come and become president,
under Ronald Reagan he became Fed.
Under Ronald Reagan. Okay, it was 1987. Sorry, under Ronald Reagan. A few years before, when he was still a director of Morgan Guarantee Trust Company, as they used to call themselves then, he met up in Vail, Colorado, with Henry Kissinger and Brzezinski and Rockefeller, and he promoted the idea in 1983 that Latin American countries like Mexico, remember that in 1982 the Mexican debt bomb exploded, and then all of Latin America started, you know, falling like dominoes. They started defaulting on their debt. That included Argentina, too. That was one of the many foreign debt defaults we had. And he said, these Latin Americans, they're not really going to be able to ever pay the debt back. And we don't really want that. What we have to find is a way where we can change the debt they have into equity in their public utility companies. And that's where he really kicked off what is called down here privatizations. And Alan Greenspan said, all we need to do is have the right governments in place who will sanction the right laws that we need so that we don't have a problem with their sovereignty and they can just let go of all their companies. And that's the way 8, 9, 10 years later, at least in the case of Argentina, it was 8 years later with President Menem, he changed all the laws. He did everything that the bankers asked. And they were able to say, okay, we'll turn your foreign debt into debt bonds, and we'll swap those debt bonds for your oil company, your airline, your electricity company, your mineral company, and everything. And they literally bought up with junk bonds Argentina, and they are now owners of practically all our natural resources.
Oh, absolutely, Adrian. It's a sick story, and what went on in Argentina has gone on in so many other places. And I can remember one thought just came to my mind in writing about GMO foods and the horror of that poison that is literally polluting the world, not everywhere, but it's moving gradually to maybe pollute the whole world if it isn't stopped. But one country that was terribly victimized early in the GMO game was Argentina, where your corrupt politicians basically just let the big agribusiness companies come in and plant GMO crops over, I don't know how many acres Argentina has, but I think
soya. It's all over the place.
It's everywhere.
Genetically modified soya has practically invaded all of Argentine fields, all Argentinian fields.
And the stuff,
and that is really tragic because it's destroying the land. They put a lot of agrochemical products in it to make it grow faster. And so it's very in other words, although they plan long-term, they do their business very short-term. They just want the quick buck because it's not only a quick buck for them, it also serves the purpose of debilitating, of weakening the host country, in other words, the victim country, so to speak.
Well,
so it's a very finely engineered process. And in Argentina, I think that's one of the subjects that you mentioned earlier, it has the added disadvantage that for various rather complex reasons, international Zionism, which is part of the whole power elite, has very specific long-term plans regarding Argentina's territory. So when you put that all in, it's a particularly explosive formula, and it's we suffer the consequences on a daily basis down here.
You sure do, and I must say, few Jewish people understand what Zionism really is. They just tend to equate it with Judaism, but Zionism, if you understand Zionism, and I've written a fair amount about it, and if you understand Judaism, and I'm no Judaic expert, but I know the Jewish education that I got and the upbringing I got, and there is absolutely no relation between Zionist aims.
Right.
And the tenets of Judaism that I was taught, especially by good parents who raised me right.
I'm sure.
Let's segue into that. Talk about Zionism a little bit, Adrian, from your point of view, and then talk about what Israel is doing or wants to do, either has already done or wants to do in Argentina.
Well, you know, I'm very glad you touch upon this subject and you give me the chance to mention it, because every time I try to discuss this here locally, the first thing, or a lot of people, the first thing they'll say, or the local media, the first thing they will say is, oh, you're an anti-Semite. And I go, wait, I am not. I'm not anti-anything, okay? Let's start, at least not as far as ethnic groups are. I'm not anti-black, anti-Chinese. I'm not anti-Italian. I'm not anti-Jewish. I'm not anti-anything.
Oh, and Adrian, people like me are called a self-hating Jew.
Yeah, I know.
You know, the last refuge of somebody who does not want the truth exposed, so they blame the truth teller.
No, and they try to describe you like you're some sort of a schizophrenic that, you know, you have a self-hate complex or some ridiculous thing like that. Now, what I always say, and I've written an essay that I'd even like to send it to you over the email later. I wrote an essay, and I'll tell you why I wrote the essay later, which is called Anti-Semitism. And I say, well, let's start getting our ideas right. There are four categories. First of all, the Jewish people. A very tiny community. Even official figures say that there's only about 16 or 17 million Jews in the entire world. And official figures for Argentina are something like 400,000 Jews, over 40 million people. I mean, it's a tiny community. They keep to themselves in many parts of the world, but they are definitely, definitely not a problem here at all, ever. Second, the Jewish religion, as you were just saying, it is a religion which is 5,700 years old, and it has one particularity, and a lot of people laugh at me when I say this. Contrary to certain Protestant sects, like, I don't know, Jehovah's Witnesses, that knock on my door every Sunday and they say they want to save me, and they're very evangelical and so forth, the Jews don't bother anybody, because Judaism is not even a militant evangelical religion. Nobody ever knocks on your door. A Jew will never, ever, ever bother you with his religion. So what's the problem there? None. Third category, Zionism. Hold on a second. Zionism is a political movement founded at the end of the 19th century. Leon Pinsker from Russia, the Viennese lawyer, Theodor Herzl, and it has very specific territorial demands, very specific even ethnic and rather racial at times objectives, and they have done what they actually did with the State of Israel, by using terrorist groups. I mean, the Irgun Zwei Leumi of Mr. Menachem Begin, the Stern Gang, which was in the hands of Yitzhak Shamir, even the Haganah that more or less got along with the Brits, but they were all basically militant, even terrorist organizations. So that's something very political, Zionism. And the fourth category is the State of Israel, which is a foreign power founded in 1948. So let's not mix everything up. And the reason why I had to write this is because when I have a newsletter down here, and I wrote a series of articles very strongly condemning what Israel did in southern Lebanon in the middle of 2006. So I was treated as a virulent anti-Semite by one of the local Jewish militant groups here, the Daya. They're actually the guys who had their headquarters bombed in 1994. And I went back and said, no, I have nothing against the ethnic group of the Jews or the Jewish religion. It's Zionism that I am complaining about, and most of the world was completely horrified when they saw what was done in 2006 in Lebanon, and even worse, what they did in Gaza in 2009. So, you know, somebody somewhere tries to confuse the whole thing so that every time you criticize the state of Israel, they falsely accuse you of saying these guys are anti-Semites. And it doesn't work that way. If you were to criticize Argentina's government, I would say, oh, I fully agree with you. I wouldn't say, hey, you're being anti-Argentine. I'm insulted.
Well, I feel exactly the same way. And I write an awful lot about Israel and Palestine, Adrian, and I absolutely separate the state. The state is a political state and the religion is a religion. And for me, there's a firewall between the two. Well, of course, Israel calls itself a Jewish state. That's another issue, but that's a political decision. It's not a religious decision. So they want a state that ideally would be ethnically cleansed of anybody who isn't Jewish. And the number one target, of course, are Muslim people, Arab people, Palestinians, Arabic people. But Christians aren't particularly welcome either. There are Christians in Israel. I think a fairly small population, and there are scattered numbers of some other religious groups, but the two dominant ones are Jews and Muslims, and in Israel alone, 20% of the state of Israel is Muslim.
Yeah.
And they're treated like criminals. They're treated like criminals. They're denied rights. They're persecuted, not to the degree yet that the Palestinians are in the territories where they literally live, especially in Gaza. Gaza is nothing other. It's called an open air prison. Call it an open air prison. Call it a concentration camp. Call it what you will. That's the condition those people live under. I hear the music in the background. Let's take a short break, Adrian.
Sure.
You can catch your breath, grab a sip of water, and then we'll pick it up when we come back.
Certainly. Thank you.
For the independent mind.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Sierra Club Radio. Tune in Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to hear interviews with green authors, activists, politicians, celebrities, and more.
Tune in to Cities Grace Notes, where we'll be bringing you inspired voices from around the world. Creative voices from various fields and backgrounds. New sounds, new music, and new ideas with your host, CD. Every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, Kara Lee@GaryNull.com. KARALEE@GaryNull.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back. On with Adrian Salvucci. We are talking about Argentina, about Israel, about Zionism, about the Bilderbergers. This has been a very, very interesting conversation, Adrian. I want to focus your attention on one thing, because as much I have written volumes on Israel-Palestine, literally over my short writing career of about 5.5 years, enough to fill at least a few books, but I have never written anything nor know anything about what Israel is now doing, has done, or plans to do in Patagonia. Explain it to me and to listeners.
Absolutely, and I just released a video, which is in Spanish, and also an article, which is also in Spanish, but I promise that I will be translating that, both the video and the article, into English, because I think it is something of great importance, especially now that thanks to Internet and Internet radio, and you know, guys like you and me can just sort of talk and communicate, and we can really exchange ideas much more freely than we could 10, 20, or 30 years ago. We all know, or anybody who has studied the subject a little bit in depth, that the father of Zionism, so to speak, are two gentlemen, Leon Pinsker, who wrote a book called Self-Emancipation, but much more so, Theodor Herzl, who was a Viennese lawyer who died very young, unfortunately, and he began the International Zionist Congresses. And his seminal book, which is called A Jewish State, was published in 1896 in German, in Vienna, and has been translated into just about every language in the world. And there's a chapter, which is, and this will explain to you why I have a specific interest and a great concern as far as Zionism is concerned, and a lot of people have it in this country. There is an article in his very short book called The Jewish State, which says, Palestine or Argentine? Now, that's enough to worry anybody. And he says that although the ideal thing would be to be able to set up the Jewish state in Palestine, in other words, in the Holy Land, I mean, he was writing this in 1896, but at that time, Palestine was part of the Ottoman Turk Empire, and they tried to talk to the Sultan over in Constantinople, and or in Ankara, I should say, and the guy said, no way, you know, we're just not going to give you that land. Okay, he couldn't imagine that the First World War would come about, that would be turned into a British mandate, and that the what seemed as almost impossible of setting up a Jewish state in Palestine would become a reality 50 years later in 1948. So he said, going back to 1896, let's think of an alternative land. And he toyed with the idea of Uganda and a couple of others, but he said the ideal place would be Argentina. And he says, why Argentina? Because Argentina is a very rich country. It has immense and huge territory. It has a very, very low population. It has a very moderate climate. And he literally says, I'm reading this, I'm quoting this from the book, Argentina would have the greatest interest of ceding a part of their territory for financial compensation. Now, okay, let's just leave that there, and let's fast forward 102 or 103 years forward. When we had our collapse back in 2001, 2002, this country went into default with its public debt and so forth. And the New York Times from New York City published an article on the 27th of August, 2002, with the following title, Some in Argentina See the Secession of Patagonia as a Way of Paying their Argentina's Foreign Debt. Newsweek picked up the idea in their issue 23rd September 2002, and it all ties in perfectly, conceptually at least, into the whole idea of saying, let's make sure that Argentina is always kept with a very low population, which has been achieved, because Argentina should have 140 million people, and we're only 40 million. Think of it. This country is six times the size of France, and yet we only have 40 million people. Patagonia is almost completely uninhabited because of various political distortions. The five provinces of Patagonia have a combined population of only 1.6 million people, while several of the counties in suburban Buenos Aires have a population of 1.6 million people. So, you know, it's we have a severe demographic distortion in this country. And
tell me one thing. How big is Patagonia in relation, if you can judge off the top of your head, say, to
California.
Three times the size of California?
Yes, sir. Three times
California. Oh, my goodness. Patagonia alone?
California has 38 million people, so three times the size of California. We're talking about 130 million people, and yet Patagonia has 1.6 million people.
No, I'm not talking about square miles.
It was square mile. Well, let me just think. We don't use miles. That would be. It must be about a million square kilometers, which would come out to about 700,000 square miles.
Now, how does that relate to California?
Well, I'm just looking at a map. I'll be quite honest. Maybe I'm not looking at the right projection, but I would imagine that's about two and a half to three times the size of California.
Well, then it's a massive piece of real estate.
Oh, and you know what's even more important? It has everything you can think of: minerals, oil. It has grazing fields. It has potable water. It has just about everything, and very, very, very important for the New World power elite.
Well,
it has a geostrategic location, which is very important when you look towards what is still the last continent to be conquered from the point of view of ravishing its natural resources, which is Antarctica. I remember about 20 years ago, I saw an interview with Henry Kissinger on American television, and the guy who was interviewing him said, okay, let's make a ping pong of questions. And he started asking him questions. And then he says to Henry, Argentina, and Henry thought for a moment, and he said, it's a dagger pointing at Antarctica. And I said, wow, this guy knows his geopolitics, because it certainly is a dagger pointing at Antarctica, because not only does Patagonia itself have huge wealth, but military bases and even scientific and even commercial bases in Patagonia are perfectly poised to start taking all the wealth from Antarctica. But the thing is that what happened, and what really makes a lot of people down here very concerned, is that a whole host of other things have been occurring over the past 50, 60 years, which ties into this idea of splitting Argentina into two, making Patagonia a separate country. For example, all our so-called democratic presidents have always been very functional to this new world order system. So once we got the last military regime off our backs, the first democratic or so-called democratic president we had was a guy by the name of Alfonsín, and he had the brilliant idea of moving Argentina's capital to Patagonia. Now, it never actually happened, but they made such a big fuss of it that the idea sort of is hanging around there that Argentina is a country with two capitals, Buenos Aires, which is the present capital, a very huge city, and then another one in Patagonia. And it happens that he announced that on the week after he had met in Bariloche, which is the main city in Patagonia, with Zbigniew Brzezinski. Always the excuse was some sort of a hotel, a conference or whatnot. And then you have our major newspapers. Mind you, I prepared my article not based on bad sources, but on our top newspapers. Our main newspaper, which is very traditional, called La Nación, they ran an article on 5th of January 1986, where they interview a guy who is supposedly the spokesman for young Israelis who are walking all over Patagonia. And the explanation that they give is that these so-called Israeli hippies, when they finish their military service, they are sent to various parts of the world, like Patagonia, so that they can look around and see where they can set up other settlements. And the guy said, Argentina has the right climate, the right flora, the right fauna, the right wealth and everything. It would be even easier to set up a settlement here than it was in Israel back in 1948, 49, and 50, and this would be the ideal place to set up Jewish settlements.
So
all these things, when you put them together, you figure, well, there clearly is a plan to do something regarding Patagonia.
But they have not done it yet?
No. I don't think so. As a matter of fact, I don't think it'll be anything like an invasion. A lot of people here, especially, you know, you have to be careful, and I have to say this. Like every country, we have a lot of these right-wing lunatic fringes here, too. So a lot of them will say, we're going to be invaded by the Americans, we're going to be invaded by the Israelis. We have, you know, and that is bad, because I will admit that a lot of those people down here, because there is bad information all in all, will tend to even say, it's the Jews who want to take over the country. I go, wait a second, it's not the Jews. We're talking about Israel, we're talking about Zionists. Let's be disciplined and let's stick to the facts. But for example, the way that they have chosen to do this, I think, is not through direct military intervention, but rather by imposing on Argentina an unpayable foreign debt, which is what we have right now. It's the main controlling factor. They've done it by financing the political campaigns of local politicians who are the guys and the women who actually contracted that debt. In other words, we've done that. We've shot ourselves in the foot, so to speak. And all they need is for somebody to from local government to implement those laws that they need so that their corporations can come in here and invest. They can go into Patagonia and buy huge tracts of land. We have people like Ted Turner, Douglas Tompkins, Joseph Lewis from the UK, George Soros. George Soros has bought huge tracts of land, and his local man here, a guy by the name of Eduardo Elstein, is a typical example of how this works. This guy Elstein, he is the largest landowner in Argentina, especially in Patagonia. Listen to this, Stephen. He is a member of the America Society, set up by David Rockefeller. The America Society is exactly across the street up on Park Avenue at 67th Street in New York City from the CFR, from the Council on Foreign Relations. He was named treasurer of the World Jewish Congress by his friend and associate Edgar Bronfman from Seagram's. He owns the Argentine Mortgage Bank. He is a regular at the World Economic Forum, presided by Klaus Schwab from the Trilateral Commission. He owns huge numbers of real estate and so forth. He is one of the main members of the Yabad Lubavitch militant Jewish Orthodox group here, who are very pro-Israel. So when you put all of that together, and he is also George Soros' henchman here, you figure evidently there is a much wider, a much more subtle plan of slowly getting into Patagonia and turning it into their own use. I personally think, and this is an idea I'd like to sort of mention to you because this might even have world application, that they will be using, that they are using, the model of the British East India Company. I would imagine that sometime in the relatively near future, they're going to concession Patagonia. They're going to privatize it for 99 or for 599 years. It doesn't make any difference, into a joint venture unit, which will include all the major oil companies. It will include all the major mining companies. It will include Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and I don't know, and Citicorp. It will include media companies. It will include tourism companies because, you know, this is a beautiful tourist area, and it will also include members of Argentina's government, so we can sort of make it look nice. And they will just say, let the Argentine flag wave in Patagonia, but we're going to start calling this company Patagonia Limited or Patagonia Inc. We're going to give it a logo, and maybe 40, 30, 50 years down the road, people will just identify that Patagonia is a private enterprise run by a joint venture of multinational corporations.
Well,
that's the coming model.
You've got it exactly right, Adrian. There's no question. And the best way to conquer a country is don't do it with invading armies. Do it financially. And the best way to do it financially is get the country in debt. And the whole game, the whole dirty game that the big international banks play is they don't want debts paid off. They want debts going on ad infinitum forever.
You're my man. I say this all the time, and people look at me with a blank look like Homer Simpson on their faces. Banks don't want you to pay the debt back. They want you to roll it over ad infinitum.
That's exactly right. The worst thing an indebted country could do is pay off its debt. It's the dirty game of the international bankers, of the IMF, of the World Bank. It's enslaving countries by debt. And then the dirty game that you said is the way you handle your debt. You have to service your debt. That comes ahead of everything. So you cut your social services. You
exactly.
Privatize. The term is structural adjustments. You make the people take the pain, pay the price. You let the big banks, the big corporate interest, they're the ones that benefit. They literally to get a license to come in and rape and pillage. And this is going on around the world today. In the 1990s, it went on in Latin America, the neoliberal pillaging. It went on in Eastern Europe when the Soviet Union was broken up. The republics were never the same again. They longed for the old Soviet Union with all of its pitfalls, all of its flaws. My God, at least if they got sick, they could go to the hospital and somebody would take care of them. It might not be perfect, but at least somebody would take care of them. Now, you can only get it if you pay for it. You can only get anything if you pay for it. And now in economic crisis, the benefits are literally being stripped away, including in America. The dirty plan in America is to end Social Security and Medicare and all social benefits and basically turn America into a country like Guatemala, which I say on this program, and I'm saying Guatemala in the worst sense of the word, with all the police state repression and the rest of it, because people get angry if they get sick and nobody will take care of them, if they get hungry and nobody will feed them, if they get homeless and nobody will house them. They get angry. They damn well should get angry. They should get angry when they realize that their government has ripped them off and government has partnered with criminal corporations to do this to them. But let me just get clear on this one point, Adrian. As of now, Israel has not embarked on whatever plan it may have in Patagonia. It's a plan. It's not a reality. Is that right?
It's a plan. It's not a reality. It's something that you have to look at it in perspective. And, you know, if you project something, you reach the old adagio. If it looks like a duck, it goes quack like a duck, it's yellow like a duck, and it's got a beak like a duck, it most likely is a damn duck. So when we start projecting everything that is happening, you realize that there is a mega plan to control Patagonia. And within that mega plan, I envision that at some point, and we may have already reached that point, they will need Patagonia for a massive migration of Israeli citizens down there, because Israel, especially after Lebanon in 2006 and Gaza in 2009 and the Netanyahu they have in there right now, and God forbid if they go against Iran, Israel is becoming increasingly an unviable state, an inviable state. So, and there's a lot of people, and I admire that, who are very, very warlike, and they will stay in Israel for no matter what. But there's about another half of the population who don't like the war in Israel, who are dead set against the government, who are also maybe old, infirm, maybe it's 3 million people, 2 or 3 million people, and they will need a place where they can even transfer them over to. And in Patagonia would fit that perfectly, because they can make an initial transfer of, say, 3 million Israelis to Patagonia, and from then onwards it would be like a second Jewish state, which even ties in with the Bible a little bit, where you had the realm of Judea and the kingdom of Israel. You know, it was sort of a double figure type thing. Well, then they might want to even repeat that model a little bit. Well, but it is not a reality, not now. I mean, we will be exaggerating if we were to say they've taken it over. And I don't think they ever will do that very explicitly, because it will look very bad in the 6 o'clock news.
Oh, well, absolutely. The Israeli army invading Argentina, that really would look bad. I mean, even when the British came over in the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher wanted a little war to distract people from the UK was going through an economic crisis at that time.
Yeah, Maggie Thatcher and so forth.
I don't remember, but she might have had an election coming up as well. But there was a lot of internal trouble. So, when you're in trouble at home, what do? You distract your local population. And what is the tried and true way of doing it? You start a war, and you get the people, and you scare people about the enemy that you're going after to protect the people, so they forget about the fact that they lost their job and they're hungry, and they don't want those invading Argentines coming over and taking over the UK or something like that.
Well, you know, the Argentine generals, General Galtieri at that time, he did it because he had domestic problems, and he said, okay, I'll go invade the Malvina Falkland Islands, and that'll make me a hero. And if he had been able to pull it off, it would have made him a hero.
He would have made him a hero, indeed.
but this all ties in with something that I'd just like to very briefly touch upon, and if you like, we can go
absolutely.
Further in another program. The Argentina's foreign debt is the main excuse to control our economy, our education, our everything. The IMF come in here and they tell us what to do, what not to do, and so forth, and they have pauperized the country to the benefit of the bankers. However, that foreign debt that we are paying today, 2010, and we can't pay it because we can't even pay the interest. We pay about every year. We pay about 2/3 of the interest and then roll over the capital plus the remaining interest forwards, just as you were saying a few minutes ago. But that foreign debt, because Argentina did not have a foreign debt until 1976. When this military government takes over, the first thing they do is they start indebting the country hugely. And it was basically illegal debt because it went against the interest of the people, and it was a totally illegal government. So what was the main threat to the bankers? That when we had democracy coming back in 1983, that was 7 years, almost 8 years later, that somebody would investigate that foreign debt, and we could probably reclassify it as odious debt and not pay it at all. So what the powers that be were very successful at is that they always financed local politicians who could do anything you can imagine, except investigate our foreign debt. And since 1983, when democracy came back, until today, all our politicians have done all the mischief and all the corruption you can possibly imagine, but not one of them, nor did one single Congress, say, hey, we're going to investigate the foreign debt. Because if we did, even today, about 80% of our foreign debt can be traced back to that military regime, and we can say we're not going to pay it because there is jurisprudence that calls it odious debt, in which the bankers will have to show that they did not know that those military were persecuting our own people and so forth. So the trap is so well done that they actually exploit us using our own local corrupt politicians who are very generously financed by major corporations, the local media, which is all in their hands, and the major bankers.
Oh, it's amazing. The history we don't know, the facts that we don't know, Adrian, are always the most important ones. And the world ties together. You're talking about Argentina, and we cross the world to Israel, and we come back to America, and we can basically tie the whole South American continent in, and yeah. I guess North America, because Canada and Mexico are joined at the hip with the U.S., and of course the West as well. We get into Western Europe. I mean, everything seems to tie together, and although there are rumbles for independence, China, India a little bit, certainly countries, Iran, Venezuela, Russia, some countries, and even alliances in South America, the ALBA trade alliance with Venezuela and other countries that simply want no part of the NAFTA type agreements. But we tie everything together, so it almost doesn't matter. You can be in Argentina, I can be in Chicago, and we live in the same world, and we're affected by the same things.
And we have a common enemy.
Oh, we have a common enemy, indeed. So,
and it's not a particular people or a particular religion or a particular ethnic group. It is, I would say, it's an overstructure of extremely powerful billionaire or trillionaires who have common interests. And when they have common interests and objectives, they get together, cozy, have their fights behind closed doors. But then when they move forward for those interests and against us. Why? It really gets me very angry to say conspiracy theory. No, people who have common interests and common objectives, it's natural that they will get together and see how they can promote and strengthen those common interests and those common objectives. The ridiculous thing would be to say, hey, David Rockefeller would never dream of picking up the phone and talking to Henry Kissinger, and Henry Kissinger wouldn't even think of talking to George Soros, and George Soros wouldn't even imagine talking to Brzezinski. Of course they do, and they do it together, and they do it very powerfully, and that's why we have the world we have, and not a kinder, gentler nation like George Bush promised 25 years ago.
They practically go to bed with each other. I mean, they're cavorting with each other all the time, and indeed, and in this country, Adrian, I imagine it's true to some degree in Argentina and throughout Europe and other places. In this country, without any question, big money owns politics. Politics is a servant of big money. So here we get, we call it democracy, but there's no democracy in America. We get the best democracy money can buy. You get enough money, you can buy as much of it as you want. If you have no money, you get none of it. And that's called the American way, Adrian.
Right, and it's the same the world over. So it's got to be a global model, obviously.
Oh, indeed so. And the Rockefellers and the Soruses and the Bronfmans and these type people, they're the ones who control things. They're businessmen, but the politicians are their tools.
Exactly.
And they better obey the orders they get or else.
Otherwise, they'll end up like John F. Kennedy.
Exactly so. A final thought. We've got about a minute left. A final thought, Adrian.
Well, you know, I think that the important thing is, and I'm very thankful to you for giving me the chance to be on your show, is the more people understand all of what is really happening, how the world really works, and they stop listening and thinking that the world works the way CNN or Fox News or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal say, the more people wake up, I think we're reaching a critical mass where things might tip over on a global basis because there are thinking people all over the place, and that, and to give a little bit of stamina and faith in what we're doing, that critical mass of clear thinking people is much, much, much smaller than most people imagine. Great things in history have always been done by very tiny groups of people. So I think that you in America and me in Argentina and all sorts of folks all over the world who are doing the same thing, the more we awaken and enlighten our people, the closer we'll get to that critical mass. And I think that the global power elite knows it. That's why they are so damn nervous and hysterical, because you can also sense that when you see the way they act and the way they do things.
Oh, there's no question, and there's a great quote I don't have in front of me, but the gist of it from the former anthropologist, now long gone, Margaret Mead. The quote is something to the effect that never underestimate the power of a few determined people to change the world. And she ended the quote saying, "It's the only way the world has ever changed." And, of course, I see it all the time in this program, Adrian. It never comes from the top down. The only way the world will change is if we, people listening to this program, change it. And most important, if we decide we want to, we can do it.
Amen, my friend. Very good.
Oh, Adrian, I hope we could do this again. This has been this was a marvelous, marvelous conversation. I hope many people heard it, and those who missed it listened to archives. And if they did, they're going to know who you are, and they're going to email me and say, "You've got to get this guy back." And absolutely, I want to get you back, Adrian.
I'm at your full disposal. We're on the same bandwagon, so we're doing exactly the same thing.
Many, many thanks.
Take care.
You too. And join us again tomorrow, same time. Oh, another vital topic with another guest who's been on before, and a core topic for me. And today we ranged on many core topics. It's why I always say make this a regular habit, and absolutely make Progressive News Network a regular habit. It's the reason it's become the most popular online alternative service. If they didn't have good programming, it never would have happened, but they do. And I'm delighted that this program is part of this system. It's a great family to be with. Join us tomorrow.